This podcast is brought to you by Fidelity Investments. Find yourself on solid ground at Fidelity. We bring 75 years of experience and are hiring licensed financial planners near you. Visit branches.fidelitycareers.com. Fidelity is an equal opportunity employer.
Welcome to Tech News Briefing. It's Tuesday, July 18th. I'm Zoe Thomas for the Wall Street Journal. Machines coming to replace us all sounds like a line out of Hollywood. And it is. It's the fear that both writers and actors have expressed as they've gone on strike.
Actors on strike! We're in it to win it! Writers on strike! We're in it!
Both are concerned about how technology, particularly artificial intelligence and streaming, are going to upend the industry. Our media and entertainment reporter Joe Flint will join us to explain. Plus, got any international travel planned? We'll tell you about the hack that can help you save money on your cell phone data. Starting, though, with Hollywood, actors and writers have been striking after unions representing each failed to reach deals with the Alliance of Motion Pictures and Television Producers, a coalition representing movie and TV studios, networks, and streamers. A major sticking point in the talks has been how the industry should adapt to new technologies. Here's Fran Drescher, the president of SAG-AFTRA, which represents actors.
The entire business model has been changed by streaming, digital, AI. This is a moment of history that is a moment of truth. If we don't stand tall right now, we are all going to be in trouble. We are all going to be in jeopardy of being replaced by machines.
Our media and entertainment reporter Joe Flint is here to talk us through this. So Joe, let's start with artificial intelligence. What specifically are the actors' concerns here?
Actors are concerned about a couple of things. One, that their likeness could be used over and over again without their authorization and, as important, without being compensated. And two, the idea that perhaps certain technology, AI, can be used to actually perhaps eliminate the role of some actors, be they background actors, that kind of thing.
How do those concerns differ from the writers who are also on strike?
The writers are concerned about ChatGPT, another form of artificial intelligence, and the potential that could have in terms of creating scripts, in terms of cutting the writer out of the script-making process. I'm by no means an expert in technology, so forgive this rather silly example, but the idea being that, hey, I need a good Western. Well, let's just throw 10 classic Westerns into a machine and see what it comes up with.
We've already seen AI used in film, though. I mean, why is this something that actors and writers are raising now?
Well, the technology is advancing now. It's one thing to use AI or certain technologies to de-age Harrison Ford or Al Pacino in a movie. It's another thing entirely to perhaps use AI to take an actor's body of work or their likeness or their voice and use it without any authorization. And that's the concern of the actors. I want to be clear, the studios are just as concerned about AI as well. It's not like they own the AI machines. And if someone is putting scripts of Modern Family into a machine to train AI, well, then Disney, that owns the IP for Modern Family, is also going to be like, where's my money?
All right, let's talk about the other technology that both of these groups have been concerned about, streaming. The unions representing the actors and the writers have both said that streaming has changed the industry for their members. How so?
What streaming did was really change the business models. And initially, everyone loved streaming as a business model. You were making fewer episodes. You didn't have to worry about ratings. And Netflix did these deals where they gave you big advance payments. Then, though, as streaming continues to go on and these companies begin to make money from it, particularly Netflix, a lot of companies are still struggling with streaming. Disney is not making money. HBO Max or just Max has had one profitable quarter. Paramount Plus, not making money. But the lack of transparency for a performer, be it actor or writer, in terms of how popular your show is, beyond Netflix's top 10 list they put in their site, you really don't know, limits your ability to negotiate. And also, limits your ability to make sure you're getting what you need from all these other markets around the world.
I just want to take a moment to talk about something called residuals, which is how a lot of people in Hollywood make money. Can you just explain what that is and why it's so important in these conversations about streaming?
Not everyone is a superstar. Not everyone working in the industry, in fact, most people working in the industry, are not the cast of Friends making over $1 million an episode. They're working actors whose salaries are tied to a rate card. And so the residuals often are what sustain actors in between dry periods, if they're lucky enough to be in a show that has residuals. So the model doesn't really exist the same as it does in broadcast or cable TV as in streaming, because the information is so secretive. We knew how many people were watching an episode of Friends every week and how many were watching the reruns of it on TBS. On Netflix or Max, we don't necessarily have that data. So if you're negotiating on behalf of these performers or trying to figure out what your residual or cut of it should be, it's sort of walking around with a blindfold on.
What are the actors and writers asking for in terms of changes to how much money they make based on streaming?
One is they just want general wage increases, and then they want the residuals increased for streaming in terms of the percentage, but they also want more transparency in terms of the numbers so that they can see how popular these shows are.
We should add that the Alliance of Motion Picture Television Producers say they've offered very significant raises and protections around AI. But Joe, how long could these strikes possibly go on for?
Well, initially, when it was just the writers, we were thinking, oh, we'll get through the end of summer and then everyone will sit back down and cut a deal. The actors going on strike has obviously re-energized the writers as well. It'll start to hit the audience for movies in 2024. Right now, you have movies and streaming companies. They bankroll a lot of content. They make stuff in advance, put it on the shelf, and that's how the movie biz works too. But, you know, we get into September, October, November, it's going to start to mess with their production schedules. And for the broadcast networks and cable channels, well, that's already happening. I mean, right around now is when writers are reporting back to duty to write new episodes for the next season, and actors come in and start filming, and nothing's happening on that front. So the fall TV season will be pretty light for a lot of people.
All right, that's WSJ's media and entertainment reporter, Joe Flint. All right, after the break, adding a second line to your existing phone could have a big impact on your wallet and your work-life balance. We'll explain how to pull it off when we come back.
This podcast is brought to you by the Kellogg School of Management. Getting to the next level of your career requires a next-level education. At Kellogg, you'll choose from full-time, part-time, or executive MBA programs where you'll gain the Wall Street edge you need to compete for the most coveted jobs. For more details, visit kell.gg/leader. That's kell.gg/leader.
Is it time to consider a dual SIM smartphone? The feature enables users to have two wireless plans with just one smartphone. It's been popular overseas for years and has gained traction in the US with the rise of virtual embedded SIM cards, or eSIMs. Our personal tech news editor, Shara Tipkin, has been looking into dual SIM options and even been trying them out. She joins us now. So Shara, what's the main reason someone might want a dual SIM?
There are kind of a bunch of reasons, but the main reason is travel. So instead of having to pay your carrier $10 a day to use your phone overseas, you download one of these eSIMs, you pay maybe like $10 to have data that will last you the whole time you're there and just do everything on your phone that you'd want to do back home. Generally, it means you can't place local calls or text people, but you can use all of those apps like WhatsApp or iMessage, just like you would use them in the US.
You mentioned messaging apps, but there's also maps, translations, making reservations. Most of that we do online through our data plans, not through a phone call. And $10 a day can really add up. So how does somebody go about setting up one of these dual SIMs if they want one?
There are a bunch of new providers, so you should comparison shop because they're all really competitive. So basically, you download the apps for these companies is the easiest way to do it. You choose what data plan you want, and then they walk you through the process of downloading the eSIM. And then you just activate the data plan for whatever country you want to go to. So if you are going to say like Brazil 1 week and then Australia and Japan, you don't have to download a new eSIM every trip. A lot of the other ones, you do have to download new eSIMs because they're actually using the local networks of providers in those countries.
What was your experience like traveling with a dual SIM phone?
It's funny because I'd been hesitant to try eSIMs because I wasn't sure if it was going to be complicated, you know, and I'm a personal tech editor. If it seems daunting for me, I think for a lot of people, it's, oh my God, how do I do this? In the past, I've bought local SIMs when I land in a place. So in the airport, there's always kiosks and you can go and they pop out your SIM and put in a new one. But with the new iPhone 14 and the way phones are going, you're not going to be able to do that anymore. All you have are eSIMs, so you can't actually take out your physical SIM. Downloading your first eSIM can be a little bit confusing because there are some settings you have to fiddle with. You do have to turn off data roaming on your main line so that they're not both running at the same time and you're still getting charged by your home carrier. But once you figure out what those settings are, and once you have your first eSIM installed, it really is easy.
We've been talking about travel, but you said there are other reasons why people might want a dual SIM. What are they?
What I found from talking to a lot of these new companies is that a lot of the people in the US actually buy data plans for the US. So you may have a plan that isn't unlimited data and you're getting towards the end of your plan and you just need some more data to get to the end of the month. Or maybe you have used so much data that you're starting to get throttled by your normal carrier, which means they're slowing down the speeds. Or if you have T-Mobile and you're going someplace that doesn't have good T-Mobile coverage, you might buy one of these plans that works with Verizon. So there's a bunch of reasons like that. But then the other big reason is for work. So instead of having to carry two separate phones for work, you can have your work line and your personal line in the same device.
All right, that was our personal tech news editor, Shara Tipkin. And that's it for today's tech news briefing. But if you want more tech stories, you can check out our website, wsj.com. And if you like our show, please rate and review it. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Zoe Thomas for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.